Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Medical science has led us to believe that physical illness has a physical cause. When we're not feeling well, we go to the doctor. He or she takes a look at us. They do tests, and we hope that they can do a diagnosis, figure out what's wrong, and then prescribe a treatment, and then we will feel better. But it doesn't always work quite that way. What happens, for example, when you have a patient that has symptoms, but the doctors can't find anything physically wrong with them? Or you have a case where clearly a patient does have a disease, but the doctors say that they can't do anything for them. Well, the fact is that people have indeed been confronting these situations for a long time. And traditionally, says our guest for this hour, people have come up with ways to explain the suffering of illness. Certainly, science has a way to explain that, too. But sometimes the traditional ways of explanation and the modern ways of explanation fail to satisfy. So our guest, Anne Harrington, suggests that perhaps there is a third way of explaining why it is we become ill. She writes in her new book, The Cure Within, there is more to physical illness than can be seen in the body, and there is more to healing that can be found in pills and shots. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about mind-body illness and mind-body healing, something that she deals with in her book, The Cure Within, A History of Mind-Body Medicine. It's published by W.W. Norton. Our guest, Anne Harrington, is professor of the history of science at Harvard University. She's also visiting professor for medical history at the London School of Economics, where she co-edits a new journal called Biosocieties. For 6 years, she co-directed Harvard's Mind, Brain, and Behavior Initiative. She also was a consultant for the MacArthur Foundation Research Network on Mind-Body Interactions, and currently she serves on the board of the Mind and Life Institute. That's an organization that's dedicated to cross-cultural dialogue between Buddhism and the sciences. And she's joining us this morning from Harvard, and we'll be talking about her book, and questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to join in the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And again, any point, give us a call. We'll be happy to bring you into the show. Professor Harrington, hello.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Clearly, this is a subject where there is a great deal of interest. There's a lot of popular interest, and we know that that's reflected in popular media. It's also something that scholars like you and physicians are interested in. And for all of that contemporary interest, one might get the idea that this this concern about the way that we can either make ourselves sick or make ourselves well would be recent. But right. I think one of the things that you really point out is that those kind of ideas are actually very old ideas. They're not new at all.
They're not new at all. And in one thing that you learn from beginning to look at the history, when you look at the history, is that some of the deep roots of many of these ideas don't actually lie in the sciences. And in some instances, don't even lie in medicine. Some of our deepest and most persistent understandings about how our minds may be able to affect our bodies and make us sick or well lie, for example, in religion. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was struck by doing this history was the recurrent prevalence of the religious origins of so many of these ideas. I can give you an example.
Sure.
One of the ideas that's probably the best known idea in the kind of portfolio of mind-body medical ideas and practices is the idea that if you stay positive and refuse to believe, if you're ill and you stay positive and you refuse to believe that you're not going to get better, that your positive attitude and your positive beliefs can in fact bring about the outcome that you hope for. Why do we believe this? Many people think, well, they must have done clinical trials or, there must be a lot of case studies in the medical literature. And you can look at that, and there is, that's part of the story. But the deep roots of this idea lie in a certain understanding of the gospel stories, and particularly the gospel promise that if you believe, if you have faith, the gospel promise, the promise that Jesus in the gospel stories gives to those who come to be healed, he says, you must have faith, and if you have faith, all things come to those who have faith. And there were people in the mid-19th century who looked at this and said, well, if this is what God promises us, if this is the case, then why shouldn't we actively cultivate faith in order to receive the healing that we're promised? And it was in this era that you see the emergence of these ideas that you might do visualizations in order to visualize the hoped-for outcome, that you might recite mantras or chant things. These ideas are not just New Age recent approaches to mind-body healing. They have roots that go back to the 1830s and 40s.
I think what's interesting here is that you can see over time that the medical community has changed the way that it thinks about something like this from the point where they were interested in it and they studied it and they recognized it as a phenomenon, but they weren't really quite sure whether they believed in it. And it perhaps moved them even further to try to document what works in a hard science kind of way and, in a sense, dismiss however the patient might feel about where he or she was going, to the point where I think now more and more the medical community is willing to embrace this and say, well, maybe we're still not exactly quite sure what's going on here, but if it can be of a benefit to the patient, well, why not? Let's see if we can use this.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite interesting. And the story here is pretty complicated. But there was, say, in the first half of the 20th century, an awareness that a lot of patients who were ill would respond to, not necessarily to a specific treatment that their doctors gave them, but just to the fact that the doctor showed up or spoke kindly to them or listened carefully to their story, and most notoriously and significantly would even respond sometimes when the doctor would give them something that a medication that wasn't actually a medication, a dummy pill, a placebo. The fact that patients responded to fake pills, to sugar pills, there was a lot of interest in this, but it wasn't with the idea that, well, what does this tell us about the power of the mind to actually heal the body? It was more around, what does this tell us about, in some sense, on one side, the credulity and gullibility of some of our patients and the fact that they talk themselves into getting better, but of course we know they're not really getting better because that doesn't make any sense to us in terms of the way we understand causality and illness and healing to happen. So they're just tricking themselves. There was interest in that. And then there was interest a bit later in the 20th century in, given that patients can talk themselves into thinking they're getting better, how do we protect ourselves as a profession from being tricked out by them, from being deceived ourselves, particularly when we're trying to decide whether or not a new treatment that we want to bring onto the market actually works? And this is why we have placebo-controlled trials.
Well, and you talk about a number of things, broadly speaking, either falling into the category of healing, what the role that mind can play in healing and the role that mind can play in illness. And one of the first things you deal with is this notion, and that's actually a very long-standing notion, that healing can sometimes result from our belief in the power of the healer or what it is they're doing.
Yeah.
Is that, how does now the medical community of today think about that, or do they still acknowledge to themselves at least that something like that is still going on? That is, we want to believe in our doctors and in all of the stuff that they have, the tools that they have, and the medicines that they have. We really want to believe that that's going to make us better, and that may indeed be playing some kind of role in making us better.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question, and I think that the modern mainstream medical community is enormously conflicted about the role that doctors themselves as people might play in the healing process. Because if on the one side you're committed to an understanding of medicine that says it's what makes medicine, modern medicine, so effective is the science behind it, and the drugs and treatments that emerge out of that science, and it shouldn't matter. There shouldn't be a personal equation. There shouldn't be an issue of personality. The only thing that should matter is your technical competence and deep knowledge of the science so that you can make an accurate diagnosis and so on. But at the same time, they also know that a lot of people seek out alternative therapists and practitioners in part because they seem to receive from such people a different kind of doctor-patient encounter that feels more empathic, that feels, you know, that where there's more time to listen. And people know that a lot of the mainstream medical community says, well, why do they keep going to these people in order to get treatments that we have every reason to believe don't really work? Well, it's just because they get a great doctor-patient relationship and they're having some kind of a placebo reaction to that. And they should be saying, well, that should perhaps there should be implications for that from that for the way in which we practice medicine. Some do. But admitting that then runs back in the teeth of their own sense of what it means to be a competent evidence – to practice competent evidence-based medicine. So people struggle with this.
This I'm interested in the placebo effect just because it's an amazing you really wonder, well, really, what exactly is going on here, or is it possible to answer a question like that? And certainly it's powerful. I'm just thinking about a recent study that I liked very much. This was a study where they, I believe if I'm remembering this right, it was a study about the placebo effect, and they had two experimental groups. And they had one group, and I think that they told the people what they were doing was they were studying pain relief. And they were giving people these two different medications. And all they said to the people was that one medication was really expensive. The other group was getting the medication, and the people said, "Well, this was a very cheap medicine."
And
So one with people said, "We're giving you a $20 pill," and the other people said, "We're giving you a $2 pill." And of course,
both of them were placebos, and they had a much stronger reaction.
Some of the people in the $20 pill group reported better results than the people in the $2 pill group. So there, it's even, you know, boy, that's great. You think, wow, this is really expensive. This has got to be good, and this has got to work. Well, actually, stuff works.
Yeah, you know who knows this as well as anybody are marketers. Marketers know that they sell brands every bit as much as they sell the treatment or the pill itself, and they play off the fact that people are going to be more skeptical and maybe not even literally not have as good a response to a generic version of the identical treatment that they would get if they brought the well-known brand name. Advertise there. I've long thought this, that if you want to know about how to manipulate people's placebo responses, talk to people who work for an ad agency.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ann Harrington. Let me introduce her again for the benefit of anybody who might just have tuned in. She's a professor of the history of science at Harvard University. In fact, she's chair of that department, the Department of the History of Science. She is the author of a recently published book. It's titled The Cure Within, A History of Mind-Body Medicine. It's published by W.W. Norton and takes a look at how it is people over a long period of time have thought about how the mind can make us well and the mind can make us sick, basically. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've been talking a little bit about the fact that does seem to be the case that healing can result in part from our belief in the power of the healer. So it's the belief in the healing power that's outside of ourselves. But there's also something else that we have seen, I think, again, a lot of interest in now, but I suppose is also not necessarily a new idea. And that locates the belief in the healing power inside ourselves. That is, it's not that we believe in that the doctor can make us well. It's that we somehow believe that we have the power to make ourselves well if we just think that we will be well.
That's right. So in the book, I actually the book is organized into chapters that each talk about a specific key idea or story as I talk about it. And the idea that the healer is the key element in affecting a mind-body healing, I call the power of suggestion. So this is the which, you know, we are in this story, you know, we're quite passive, we're quite vulnerable, and all the power lies in the healer and his, or usually his, ability to implant a healing suggestion into our receptive minds. In contrast, the story that you're talking about that I call the power of positive thinking, all the power, all, you know, lies within us and our powerful healing mind, you know, my powerful minds capable of healing ourselves. But in this sense, we pull the reins. And I was talking a bit about the deep origins of this story and the way in which they lie actually in the Judeo-Christian tradition and in a certain understanding of the gospel promise that through faith you shall be healed. What happens to this story is that over time, God increasingly is sidelined in the way in which we think about the power of positive thinking. Instead of having faith in order that God might heal us, the act of faith itself is increasingly believed to bring about some kind of a psychological change or a psychobiological change that itself directly brings about healing. So we move from a religious story to a secular story to a kind of medical story. And it's that story that, you know, has such cultural traction in our society today.
We have a caller. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? Somebody who is apparently in here in Urbana, I think, where we are on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Hi there. Dr. Harrington, thank you for coming on to the show. I'm curious when, you know, if the narrative sort of shifts to a sense that, you know, the patient has, you know, more control over their own healing process, as it were, to what degree does that dimension come in where the patient starts to feel a sense of inadequacy, if you will, if their own personal healing process is just not, you know, up to snuff?
Yeah, I understand.
You know what I mean? I mean, when the popular perception of the placebo effect and so on, you know, I'm surprised that it hasn't gained much more ground than it has, but I'm wondering what the psychology of the patient, what factor it plays.
Yeah, I mean, people who are critical of mind-body medicine very often raise just this point. Now, let me see if I make sure I understand the point. It's that if the argument is that you have the power in your own mind to heal yourself, then it follows that if you failed to get healed, you must not have done a good job. You mustn't have been able to rally the powers in you that are really there. So you've kind of failed. That's what you mean, isn't it?
Well, it's not a position of mine.
I do think that particularly, you know, we haven't kind of talked about the range of diseases and, you know, the kinds of suffering that tend to attract interest in mind-body healing. But cancer has historically been an area where ideas about mind-body healing and mind-body sickness have been very, very important. And here it can get quite poignant. If people believe that by maintaining a fighting spirit or refusing to believe that they won't get better, that that's supposed to cure them, and if they then continue to get worse, now, that can be, you know, that can feel like quite a tragic outcome for people. And so, you know, mind-body medicine isn't just, it's not, you know, there's some shadow sides to all this. There's some complicated sides to all this. It isn't something to simply say, isn't this wonderful that we might be able to turn around our health by just thinking good thoughts. It isn't so simple, and it probably isn't true. For a lot of things.
Is it possible to outline, you know, how to bring the patient toward that, or is that something that you want to keep, you know, in a weird way, keep away from them, that kind of information or that kind of mentality?
Well, you know? I think what you're asking a very interesting question, Ben. I do think, you know, when people then, you know, who are critical of this then ask, well, why would somebody... Now, first of all, I don't think you should try to keep things away from them, but I think you should try to understand why people are attracted to these ideas.
Ah, yeah.
And what the other ways in which these ideas can sometimes be empowering for patients who are seriously ill, even if in the end they don't get better, you know, if they have a terminal illness. It can often empower them to make changes in their lives or to feel that, you know, they haven't simply been reduced to some object of intense medical scrutiny without any and no longer a full people. So I think trying to talk to patients and listen to them. What is it about this that feel that you? Why do you need this, or why are you turning to this? And then maybe, if you're a doctor, or were I a doctor, you know, you could find a way to talk to them about how they might proceed to make use of these ideas that don't set them up in a way that, if they fail to rally, they're failures.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Is there – now, certainly we know that within medicine, there is a lot of interest in addition to what are conventional mainstream treatments, looking at some of these other things that might enhance that effect so that doctors, I think, would want to discourage people from saying you can just think yourself well. But right. They might say, well, for example, if you have cancer, you would do the conventional treatment. You'd have surgery or chemotherapy or radiation. But then there are seems to be this growing interest in the medical community of saying, but there are some other things that we can do that might that wouldn't hurt and that might help that have to do, you know, the spiritual dimension of things that do address the fact that the patient's state of mind has something to do with the outcome. Is there some good body of evidence that would say or at least suggest that this kind of complementary approach, using the conventional but then looking at other things that you can add, has some kind of measurable benefit to the patient?
I think that there is, but I also think that the best way, I think, to understand the kinds of benefits that many of these things can bring is in terms of making the entire illness experience more tolerable, mm-hmm. reducing stress, reducing anxiety, making it perhaps easier for patients to adhere to what can be often a very punishing treatment schedule. If a patient can learn to meditate while, say, going through radiation therapy, I think there's, you know, that could make that very onerous process a somewhat less onerous process, and that surely adds up to a kind of whole person approach to cancer treatment that I think should be very much welcomed. Where it begins to get trickier is if you believe that meditating, there's the body of evidence that meditation or positive thinking, or even social support, which until recently there seemed to be much better evidence, you know, might actually affect the course of cancer, that these things might help you live measurably longer. I think the evidence isn't quite there. It isn't out. People are still interested, particularly around relationships between chronic stress and the course of cancer. I think that remains an active research area. Mm-hmm. But the best way to imagine how mind-body treatments or interventions might help you if you have a life-threatening illness is, I think, by seeing the way in which they can function to take care of the whole person. Mind-body medicine is often – people are drawn to mind-body medicine often because they want to put themselves as people back into the picture. And I would recommend that that's the way physicians who – even skeptical physicians think about and be, and, you know, open their minds and hearts to, you know, to the usefulness of thinking about them that way.
We'll go on here, talk with someone next in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yes, you've addressed a couple of the questions that I had. I was diagnosed with a benign brain tumor when I was a teenager, and I read a book. I believe the author was Bernie Siegel, perhaps. Is that a name that...
It certainly is, yeah.
Okay. Mentioning some of these mind-body ideas, and specifically, I believe, he was dealing specifically with cancer. As you say, mine turned out not to be a cancerous tumor, and I did try some of the visualization techniques and things that he talked about, and certainly it did not have any effect, but it's interesting. I think my mother was concerned when I read the book that when she learned more about it, she was concerned that I would have this kind of guilty feeling if it didn't do any good. And that I certainly didn't have that feeling, although I'm sure, you know, different people react differently. The there was a lot of other interesting facts in there, and I can't remember now. That was many years ago. He cited a number of different studies. The one that does stick out in my mind that I believe was backed up with a scientific study was one where patients that, for example, had hospital rooms with windows where they could see sky had better outcomes than patients who did not. And that is an example of how people's how the mind can affect the healing process.
Yeah, that's a lovely study. It was called A Room with a View, and it was published, I think it must be 15 or 20 years ago. They were people who were all recovering post-op, from an operation, and it happened. One wing of the hospital overlooked a parking lot, and the other overlooked I think it was some sort of a field or a pleasant green pastoral view. And the people who were put in the wing with the pleasant green pastoral view required less pain medication over the period of time that they were recovering, in post-op recovery,
okay.
And were released from the hospital several days earlier. I think that is a lovely study. And it actually, it enlarges our sense of what we might mean by the mind-body, by mind-body medicine, suggests that our environment also, and the very buildings that we go to and to be treated might need might be part of the healing equation for many of us. But in terms of Bernie Siegel, In terms of Bernie Siegel was one of the most influential advocates for mind-body healing in the area of cancer. In the late 80s and into the 1990s. And one of his key arguments was one that I do find problematic, although I understand the good motivations and rationale for his arguing it. He was persuaded that there were certain kinds of personalities who are prone to cancer, who are at risk for cancer, a so-called cancer-prone personality, which is an idea that actually goes back to psychoanalytic investigations of cancer going back to the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And his argument then further was that if there's a certain – and this cancer-prone personality was supposed to be a personality who had great trouble expressing emotion and particularly giving and receiving love.
Right.
So his book was called Love, Medicine, Miracles. And the idea was that if these kinds of people are more prone to cancer – then we should – why couldn't we find a way to turn – and there are other forms of – other kinds of people, he said, who – although they have cancer, but they defy all the odds. So what kinds of personalities do these folk have?
Right.
Well, they're the cancer resistors, and they're people who give love freely and have open hearts. So his idea was that you could take people and turn them into extraordinary patients, people who would resist the would defy the odds. It – gave enormous hope to many, many people, and it caused considerable consternation within the conventional oncology world of oncology because oncologists were anxious or concerned that first the patients might blame themselves again,
sure.
But also that maybe they would feel they didn't need the chemo or the radiation, that they could, through working on their hearts and working through their issues and learning to love better, heal themselves.
Mm-hmm. I think that what I remember also from the book, though, was that he also stressed a lot about the importance of finding doctors that would, work with you and the kind of thing you were talking about helping doctors that will have conversations and work better with patients to find solutions. And
yeah, I'm sure you're right that he himself was not saying throw out mainstream medicine. But I do. I've spoken with people, and so I in no sense want to not credit that.
Sure.
But I have spoken with folk who were active in an area called psycho-oncology in the early 90s, which was interested in attempting to help patients cope better. Through sort of group therapy and other ways with their cancer diagnosis, but worried about the argument that if you just try to do psychotherapy or support, that's going to be enough. They worried about Siegel.
Oh, sure.
future. Well, I'll ring off and let somebody else have a chance.
Thank you
for
talking.
Thank you. We have a couple of other callers here, but I'd like to, we're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I'd like to introduce again our guest, Anne Harrington. She's professor of the history of science at Harvard University, where she is also chair of the Department of the History of Science. Also, for 6 years, she co-directed Harvard's Mind, Brain, and Behavior Initiative. She also was a consultant for the MacArthur Foundation Research Network on Mind-Body Interactions, and currently she serves on the board of the Mind and Life Institute. That's an organization that's dedicated to cross-cultural dialogue between Buddhism and sciences, and she is the author of a recently published book that explores this area that here we're talking about, mind-body medicine. Her book is titled The Cure Within, and it is published by W.W. Norton. Other callers here are welcome. We have some standing by, ready to go. Next is someone in Urbana and on our line, too. Hello? Yes.
I've been wondering recently about, like, maybe an anti-placebo effect. I mean, we take drugs presumably because they're supposed to do great things for us, but when you get the fact sheet, it's entirely negative, and even if you don't read it, you stress out knowing all the horrible mm-hmm. things that might happen to you. So I'm wondering if that kind of psychological effect would apply to taking drugs.
It's a great question. There's even a word for the phenomenon that you're describing. People call it the nocebo effect. And it's well known that, for example, you know, medical students who learn about diseases as they go through medical school develop the symptoms, and you know, and there are people who have worried about the fact that you now are giving, you know, you are required by law to tell patients who are given a treatment, to given a drug, every possible side effect that might happen to them, even if it's very, very rare. Our society has a number, you know, it values a number of things, and one of the things that the medical profession values is not being sued. So full disclosure and a certain kind of consumerist, transparency is also something that, we feel we need to do. Back in the bad old days or the good old days of paternalistic medicine, doctors withheld information self-consciously from their patients because they didn't want to create nocebo effects. They often wouldn't tell. It was very rare back up until the 60s, late 60s, for patients to ever be told they had cancer. So people have been aware of of the phenomenon you're talking about, and it's just something, you know, we'll continue to struggle because we probably also don't want to have that information, to be deprived of that information.
Mm. All right. Let's talk with someone in someone else in Urbana. This is line three.
Hello? Yes, hello. What struck me about what you've been saying is how similar it is to much of Christian Science, and I was wondering why you haven't referred to Christian Science and to particularly Mary Baker Eddy, who really anticipates many of your ideas.
Well, I talk a lot about Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science in the book. I don't know if you've been listening to the entire show, but earlier on I was talking about the ways in which ideas about the power of positive thinking have their origin in a certain interpretation of the gospel stories. The groups that were involved in doing those interpretations went by a number of names, Unity Science, Divine Science. One of those groups went by the name of Christian Science. And this was the group that ended up most effectively institutionalizing itself as a religion as opposed, and in a sense,
right,
avoided going through the process of secularization that many of these other ideas, because they didn't institutionalize themselves as effectively, ended up experiencing. So Christian Science is definitely part of this story, but it stands in a kind of radical edge of the larger, in our world of thinking about, the effects of willpower and positive thinking on health. Christian Science is the most radical end point of that way of thinking because it denies that illness is actually real. Illness is an error of the mind. It isn't just that, you're now sick and through the power of your mind you can make yourself well. Christian Science says you're not actually sick. you just believe you are, but this is an error, and we must now help you to understand and appreciate the error. You are perfect because you are an idea in the mind of God. Are you a Christian scientist yourself?
No, I'm not.
Right, but then so I do talk about it, but it was just a matter of sort of getting to it, and it does reinforce what I do think is a very striking broader fact about mind-body medicine, which is how complex and rich are its historical roots and connections with various kinds of American religious traditions.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And just also, I guess I want to make sure that people appreciate that in this book that we've talked about, here in the conversation, we've been talking a lot about the idea that that the mind, it is possible, if you believe, whether you believe in the doctor, you believe in the treatment, you believe in yourself, it's possible for the mind to produce some healing. The other side of this, and there it's really the other part of this book, is the flip side, and that is the idea that in a way that the mind can also make us sick, and that illness can result from psychological trauma, which we may or may not be aware, and also the idea that seems very contemporary, but again, I'm not sure that it is, the idea that the way in which we live, that is modern life, can make us sick. And there we get to the idea of the introduction of the idea of stress. And, of course, we all talk about stress now all the time. That as a term is relatively new, but again, this idea that the world that we live in, the way we live, the way we relate to life, the way we take on or deal with the challenges of life, that kind of thing can make us sick.
That's right. I mean, I think that the history of stress is filled with surprises, and one of the most surprising things about the history of stress, for at least for me, you know, researching it, was in a sense the extent to which it was actually a invention or a construction of the post-World War II era, which is not to say that before the Second World War people didn't suffer from anxiety or people didn't feel life was too much for them, but that before they had both a different vocabulary and to a certain extent they experienced the challenges of modern life differently than we've learned or been taught to experience them in our own time. And I've been very struck. I tell my students, I taught a version of this material as a undergraduate lecture course before I turned it into a book. And one of the things I tell my students who, of course, feel that they're suffering incredibly from stress, and everyone's always suffered from stress, and I tell them that their great-grandparents didn't experience stress. And they think, well, that's ridiculous, of course. But they say, well, what do I mean by that? What I mean is that back in the 1890s, turn of the century, not only was there not a word equivalent to our idea of stress, but the ways in which people responded to the challenges of modern life were not the same as the way we respond. Instead of suffering, getting overwrought and being at risk of high blood pressure or heart disease or the things we believe stress is all about, people suffered from exhaustion. They weren't overwrought. They were exhausted. They took to their beds. The kinds of symptoms that they suffered have no real parallel to the ways we think of the things we think of as stress symptoms. They couldn't stand bright lights. They had various kinds of. They would be fainting and dizziness. This is just a kind of different bodily experience, but it made full sense to them in terms of what they thought was causing their distress, which is that their nerves had been depleted of adequate energy. So back in the time of my students' great grandparents, people suffered from nervous exhaustion. We today suffer from stress, which we think of as a situation in which our bodies are being slowly poisoned by toxic chemicals like cholesterol or, you know, chronic arousal of our organs that produce a biochemistry that eventually wears us down.
And here, and I guess I get some other calls I wanted to get to, but this, yeah. I think this touches on what I think is a really interesting idea and an important sort of fundamental idea in the book, and that is our experience of illness is in some sense culturally determined.
Yes, shaped. Or at least here's the way I would put it. It was very important to me to, in writing a history of mind-body medicine, to include the bodies, to not just have the, as lived and as living entities. To not, how ironic it would be if I wrote a history of mind-body medicine that was all cerebral, that just made room for the mind. And I had learned from very early on, back when I was a graduate student working on the history of hypnosis, that the history of hypnosis wasn't just a history of changing ideas, that the actual bodily experiences, the actual things that people experienced, changed in accordance with or in tandem with the changing understandings of what kind of experience people were having. So way back in the early modern period, we didn't have hypnosis. We had demonic possession. And people reliably had experiences that seemed to reinforce an understanding that what was causing their illness was a demon. And the ways in which they were treated was all made sense in terms of that understanding. By the time we get to the 18th century, people are believing that they are getting ill because their animal magnetism is unbalanced or depleted, and there were certain kinds of treatments that they could feel. In which the magnetizer, we've all heard of mesmerism, the mesmerist or magnetizer would adjust their animal magnetism. They could feel it going into them and being adjusted. Then we stopped believing in that because science told us there was no such thing as animal magnetism, and it all became a psychological phenomenon. And again, the experiences changed. So I was struck by this as a graduate student, and I thought to myself, none of my teachers have taught me how to do history with the bodies left in, but this is something that I'm going to have to figure out. And so I struggle in this book to find ways to talk about the way, the extent to which the bodies, too, have histories.
We have about 6-7 minutes left. Our guest is Anne Harrington. She's professor of the history of science at Harvard, author of the book The Cure Within, A History of Mind-Body Medicine. Let's go to talk with somebody else here in Gibson City, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Mike Smith up in Gibson City. The reason I'm calling is that I have an interest in this field. My family background includes several osteopathic physicians. Dr. Andrew Taylor Still, who founded that, had the philosophy that the human body tended towards health, he said. And the physician's job is to work with the patient to create the conditions under which that healing takes place. I would appreciate your comments on that.
I mean, this is a nice and important question because it allows me to talk about the way in which mind-body healing, particularly many of the the strands that come out of indigenous American culture, were part of a larger sense that in this sort of late early 19th, mid-19th century, that modern medicine was all about finding what was wrong, but a certain kind of more holistic, naturopathic medicine would be about trying to make, to connect to what was still right about the person, and to believe that, in the sense the doctor never heals, nature heals. There was a broader movement called Thompsonism, that was all dedicated to enabling the natural healing powers of the body to realize themselves. Not all of the treatments or the enablers that were used were necessarily mind-body techniques that might also involve diet or certain other kinds of prescribed changes in lifestyle. But I do think osteopathy, which I wouldn't see as a mind-body treatment, but it would definitely see, is part of this larger concern to discover what is right about the body and to get the physician out of the way so that the body can heal itself.
All right. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me. I want to get one more, and this person is back here where we are in Champaign. Line two, hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Do you enter into the area in terms of the power of chi at all?
Yes, I do, actually. But there's a chapter in the book that I call Eastward Journeys.
Okay, because...
Go on.
Because actually I remember that Bill Moyers did a Healing in the Mind a number of years ago, and one of the sections was from an MD who was really sort of a non-believer, and then went to China. He was, I think, he was at Harvard.
And David Eisenberg.
And he went to China, and saw this stuff, and I think was quite taken back with the power of qi and qigong and all this sort of thing. So, anything that you'd like to comment would be appreciated.
Well, I saw Bill Moyers' Healing in the Mind back when I was in the early stages of this project, and it had a sufficient effect on me that I ended up going to China 3 times to see if I could figure out what this thing called qi was and how it might work. What I concluded from that, since I know we only have a minute or two, is that I went around China kind of asking people, so what's qi and is qi real and what... And I concluded that the question, what's qi or is there qi, is the wrong question. And the reason I concluded it was the wrong question is that qi is an explanation for something in the world, but it isn't something in the world itself. It has its roots in a much, in broad in Chinese philosophy, Taoist philosophy in particular. And that to confuse the map with the territory is just to get yourself tangled up. So I came away a bit like David Eisenberg, who's the physician that you're talking about, persuaded that there are things to be taken very seriously in the traditional methods that have been practiced for millennia in China. But whether or not you want to rush into the question about whether qi and qi energy, how does this translate into the way that the West might think about things, I think isn't going to enable the most sensitive kind of cross-cultural dialogue that you then want to begin to have once you decide you want to take these practices seriously.
We are coming down to the point where we have maybe about 2 minutes left and not a lot of time left. But I'm interested in going on a little further on this in the sense we talked a little bit earlier about recognizing the power of culture to perhaps shape the experience that people have with their illness. Here, we have a tremendous interest now among people in the West in traditional ways of thinking about health and treatment as practiced in the East. And I wonder what you make of this, of people interested in and trying to embrace something that comes out of a very different culture, has very different kind of roots an alternative to the Western kind of practice or philosophy of medicine.
That's a great question, too. I think that one of the ways that, I think there's probably a couple of stages to the answer, and I'll try to do them quickly. Initially, the way in which these Eastern practices, and particularly meditation, were brought into Western medicine was by as much as possible dissociating the practice from their original cultural origins. So a number of people have heard of the relaxation response, Herbert Benson's idea of the relaxation response. This was a very explicit medicalization of the TM practice that had been brought over to the United States by the Maharishi Mahesh and became identified with the Beatles and the counterculture and all sorts of things like that. Benson said, you don't have to be involved with any of this Eastern exotic things. This is simply a technique, a technology for turning off the stress response, and anyone can learn it. What we've seen more recently is a sense among people that they want more from their meditation than just a quick way to turn off the stress response. They want a broader cultural encounter with the wisdom traditions that – the original wisdom traditions that they think produce these techniques. So there's a lot of interest for now in, as the previous caller mentioned, in Qigong and traditional Chinese medicine, not only for its practical – benefits, but for what for the larger surround that it comes out of, and there's interest in Tibetan Buddhism and the techniques of meditation that are there. Now, how is this changing people's experiences of illness? I think it's having a not completely acknowledged or worked through effect of spiritualizing, of re-spiritualizing people's approach to mind-body techniques. Biofeedback, is a very effective technique for a lot of for stress reduction, for example. But it's a lot less evocative. It's a lot less spiritual than learning from a monk or engaging in practices in an ashram. that will connect you to something bigger than yourself. So I think opens up questions about the ways in which medicine. One of the reasons people are discontented with medicine has to do with the fact that medicine has largely secularized experiences of both suffering and healing, and people's efforts in a range of ways to re-spiritualize some of the ways in which they attempt to make themselves physically better.
Hmm. There's so much more we could talk about here. I guess I find myself really interested in the notion that at least the medical community responds to that, the feeling that maybe people are in the community, a medical community, are starting to think, you know, there is a need here. Somebody's got it. Maybe we can't fill it, but it's got to be filled somehow, and that does definitely connect with the outcome.
I think that for no other reason than they know that their patients, that it's not going to go away, and their patients need and want this. And you do see, you know, at Harvard, where I work, you can go into the university health services, and they offer wellness treatments that they will teach you meditation. Now, they've tried. There's been a mainstreaming of some of the maybe safer or less controversial strands of mind-body medicine in an effort, possibly. Well, first, an effort to give people what they think will be helpful to them and what they want, but also to make mainstream medicine more attractive, again, for people who might otherwise have been tempted to go out of pocket to an alternative practitioner.
Mm. The book is very interesting, and I suggest people take a look at it. The title is The Cure Within, A History of Mind-Body Medicine. It's published by W.W. Norton by our guest, Ann Harrington. She's professor of the history of science at Harvard. Professor Harrington, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks also to the engineers at the other end of our connection here, there at Harvard.